To mark the final weekend of the exhibition Folded Memory, a series of panel discussions and a performance were held in the gallery. Ki te ngahere, conversations about time, material and memory. Writers, researchers and artists came together to consider what is at stake when we look back in order to move forward. This episode features one of the panel discussions, exhibition co-curator Susan Ballard in conversation with artists Tarn Scott and Raywin Martin. Taking place in the Lower Chartwell Gallery, which for Folded Memory was reimagined as the forest floor, the conversation begins with Susan Ballard setting the scene.
Kia ora. Welcome to this final weekend. We're really grateful that you're here amidst all the things that are going on today. It's an incredibly busy weekend, and it's also really special for us to be here with artists from this show, but also from the previous show, Listening Stones, Jumping Rocks. Our goal today is to have a very open discussion, free-flowing discussion. We're each going to introduce ourselves, and then we've actually sort of had a series of questions that have been sort of bubbling around underground for a few weeks, and we're going to talk to and around those questions while hopefully also weaving the artworks in to our conversation as well. I'm the co-curator of this exhibition, Folded Memory. And when you came into the gallery, you will have walked past Hei Totara, a huge cross-section of a totara tree that was felled in 1906 and brought to this university, and has been on this university grounds since then. So it's been here for 118 years. And it's had a various life over that time, not necessarily always a positive and happy one. And part of our work with the exhibition was to think about what are the ways that we can fold some new stories into its life, what are the ways that we can keep it company, what kinds of works need to tell stories that cross time and space, that engage with moments of collaboration, that engage with moments of narrative, that think through what it means to be here now. And in doing that, Sophie and I curated this exhibition, and right down here, where we're sitting now, has always been thought of as the forest floor. So Hei Totara is in the canopy, and a totara pushes up through the canopy to gain the light. Right now, we're down here in the forest floor, surrounded by five artworks that to us always felt like they were the grounding of the exhibition. That's the context of where we are now. This exhibition is the second in a series of exhibitions that began with Listening Stones, Jumping Rocks 2 years ago. And in that exhibition, we conceptualized the spaces of the gallery geologically. And we were thinking about rocks, and we were thinking about geological strata. And in that process, we reimagined the gallery as a series of geological strata, not quite as literally as we have with the forest. But in that process, we included Raywin Martin's Grey Wacky Love Poems also on this floor, just in the stairwell space, which actually became the central geological structure of the gallery and of the way that we imagined it. So when we were thinking about what kind of things we wanted to do to finish this exhibition off, to tell stories of this exhibition being here and of past exhibitions and future exhibitions, we thought really the most interesting way to do that would be to fold the two exhibitions together through our voice, through our conversation. So that's why we invited both Raywin and Tarn here today, one representing forest, one representing geology, you may beg to differ, and to start thinking together about how we might fold narratives of art making in place what it means to be a human, how we work in the spaces of ecology and the environment today, and how we bring our practices together. So all of this is kind of been thought through inside the exhibition and outside the exhibition. And so what we wanted to do this afternoon was to air some of these thoughts. I sent Tan and Raywin a set of questions that were probably quite annoying, because they sought to not say, what is your work about, but more, why would you make this now? And that sort of framing of why we make this kind of work now is really where we're heading. Rather than me introduce Tan and Raywin anymore, I'd like to invite them to just introduce themselves and their work, and then we can kind of move to some of these questions. So Tan, as we're sitting with your work, would you like to go first?
Yeah, kia ora, I'm Tan. I'm an artist from Otipoti based in Tāmaki. The piece sort of behind you, or to your right, is something I worked on collaboratively with Hana Pera Aoke. Unfortunately, they can't be here today, but this piece sort of is their writing, their words impressed in metal. It's from a show we did at the Physics Room in 2022 called Invasive Weeds. The longer title is Invasive Weeds, or I Wish I Could Give You the World, but I was only given mud, rot, and the bones of a half-eaten fish. So it's all sort of, it was a collaborative show between myself, Hana, and Wesley John Fiore, an artist as well, thinking about, Hana was having their pippy, they were thinking about the future they were sort of bringing their baby into, and the climate crisis, and so we came together to make works in response to that writing. So the text really is the core of that, and here in this space, I guess, lives on in a second way. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, kia ora. Kia ora koutou. My name's Raywin Martin, and I am also an artist. I recently was living here in Te Whanganui o Tara, but am now down in Ōtautahi, where I'm teaching at Ilam School of Fine Arts. And the work that was in the 2021 exhibition was made here in Te Whanganui o Tara while I was a student at Massey University, beginning a PhD. And it was a practice-based PhD, and very much looking into the possible visual and material languages of bio-based polymers, so plant and bacterial plastics, as an alternative to some of the petrochemical materials that are used to produce paint, whether it's artist paints or industrial sort of house paint and stuff like that. But the project Grey Wacky Love Poems came about in response to the old Orfedo Bay quarry out on the south coast. And that quarry is currently a site of regeneration. So the council has invested a lot of money in that site over the past 25 years, basically. It sort of came under their care, I think, in the late 90s, early 2000s. And there was a whole process of setting up the regeneration of that site as a public space for recreation and leisure and ecology, basically. And there's, you know, all sorts of long histories along that coastline of use by mana whenua and also by early colonial settlers coming to that coastline and taking materials for use in their day-to-day lives. And if we think about the sort of colonial use of that quarry site and even the shingle along the coastline before the quarry began, a lot of that material was brought into the city and is still here underneath sort of the roadways, within the roadways, within the buildings, within the foundations. So it's this very present sort of displacement or relocation of material into the city. And I was told by some council roading contractors that there's still still material from that quarry period in some of the roads out in Karori, which maybe haven't been turned over as often as some of the central city roads. But we'll come back to that work perhaps. Yeah.
So sort of both of you have already talked quite a bit about materials, you know, the process of turning a poem into a visible physical object, and the process of sort of questioning the turning of one material into another. Has that kind of engagement with materials always been at the core of your practice, and has it always been ecological or environmental? I'm going to ask you first, Tan.
Yeah, materiality, I mean, I see myself as an object maker, so it is the core of it. The ecological aspect of that is something I sort of grapple with, because hand in hand with sort of having an output or a making-based output, you're creating constantly. And with this piece in particular, stamping it into aluminium tin, it reflects sort of questions around that, like the smelters to create that aren't, I mean, are sort of, yeah, horrific for the environment. So there's a tension with that within my making. That's sort of part of an ongoing question.
Mm. Although I read somewhere, and I may be completely wrong, and this should be wiped from all discussion, that aluminium is one of the most recyclable materials that exists, that it can actually be continually recycled and reused.
And I feel like with these as well, you're just slightly pressing into them. They're sort of recoverable and not in any way they're permanent objects, but they can have other lives.
And that kind of idea of having other lives is at the core of what you did here, right?
So the work that came to the Adam was a reconstitution. So some of the same materials that were present out at the coastline and site-specific, site-responsive installations out there in late 2019, I retrieved some of that material. Some of it was left to biodegrade into the sort of landscape there where that was obviously possible, and then stuff that wasn't going to do that, I took, you know, as an act of care and an agreement with Mana Whenua and Council, I took that away to reuse in future artwork. And it was that material that was initially reconstituted and expanded on, so sort of had a had this kind of starting point of material, which is a cellulose-based paint material that dries into a film. So you sort of mix it up a bit like mayonnaise, add pigments, and I was adding grey wacky pigment that was from rock fall from the quarry site. And I ground it into different sort of densities and then sifted it out into different particle sizes, and there were different levels of oxidization between different lumps of rock, so it had actually quite a large range of grays to work with. Mixed it into the mayonnaise and made different shades of mayonnaise, poured it out, cast it onto big sheets and dried this film. So that was some of the material used out at the coastline. Another material was this bacterial polyester, which is, rather than being a water-based paint, is a thermoplastic paint, so a melty one. So I had this one that could be rehydrated and one that could be melted, and I retrieved both of those materials from the coastline for reuse here. So there was this reconstitution process to create new sheets of material. The thermoplastic I sort of softened back down, deformed into flatter sheets again. But that material, that thermoplastic, has what's called shape memory. So it will always return to this initial configuration that you created at a higher temperature. So even though you can soften it back down a little bit, like you could soften your aluminium back down, it will actually return to this other shape. And in that case, it was the shapes of the rocks that I'd molded it around. So I brought both materials into the stairway here, and they took on quite different forms from what had happened at the coastline, but there were these moments where they did return to some of those earlier shapes and configurations.
Yeah. It's really interesting to think about, like, that idea of material return in relation to Hannah's poem. And how did you talk and work with her in terms of the words, the text, Is this a second iteration of the poem? Is it the poem itself? Where's that kind of, where's the materiality of the poem?
I see it sort of as the physical presence of the poem, mm-hmm. because the words felt so important.
Yeah.
And they, because they were what a lot of the artwork was in response to, I think we sort of felt it was really important that they were present in the space. And I wanted to sort of make them present in a way that had a greater physicality than paper, or sort of spoke to the fact that they were the core, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Does that sort of connect to the way that you and Hannah collaborated in the original show? That sense that there are a series of materials to work with, and then you bring them together in a space.
Yeah, I'm interesting. I think there's a lot of trust with how we collaborate. Mm-hmm. So Hannah sort of wrote the piece, and then I was able to go away and just respond to it. Mm-hmm. And also to do that with our friendship, to be like, okay, no, I really want to be like sort of put this work in this mahi in this time to transform their words. Yeah, and for their life here, I think, I don't know if I see it as a second iteration as much as it's still doing the same work. The conversation is just greater because it's now sort of enveloped all of the different floors and artists and makers and the pieces from the archive. And
so it enters into a new set of conversations.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's, like, when I read her poem inside the book of poems, it has one life where it's sort of folded into all the other poems. Mm-hmm. But here it has quite a different life where it's kind of unfolded in lots of ways. It's unfolded and sitting alongside the other works that are here, but also alongside your practice. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we've sort of talked about is, as Tangata Turiti, what is our responsibility to practice, and also our responsibility to making environmental and ecological work here in Aotearoa. And I'm wondering if each of you can speak to that a little bit as well. I don't know if you want to start,
yeah,
Raymond.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess this, if we think about the aluminium smelters and the forms of economy that have emerged in Aotearoa since colonisation and through ongoing colonization, you've got these sort of commodity-based industries that draw from natural resources, and I'm not familiar with the process for creating aluminium, but I did live, when I was about 5 years old, we lived in Bluffs, so right across from the Tiwai Point smelters, and sort of had a few different perspectives on the environmental impact of that, but I'd be curious to find out more, because there's that tension again. It's a bit like artists wanting to work with materials and wanting to have a relationship with materials and try new things and push the boundaries. For the community down there, people, yeah, really care about their environment, but they also want to be able to make a living in the place that they love, and so jobs are important, right? So you've got that tension around all sorts of things. But with the plant-based and bacterial polymers as an alternative to petrochemicals, you also need to think about the fact that, well, anything produced at an industrial scale, so to sort of scale up the use of alternative materials to be a viable alternative to something that's petrochemical, that will still have all sorts of ecological and social impacts that we might not yet know about, that we need to sort of be able to think through without being sure exactly, and kind of try and predict what the impacts might be and how to mitigate those. But I think it feels important to do that. I think the risks involved, I think, you know, what other choices do we have? Or that feels like the more hopeful way through our current situation, to go into that with a real understanding of historical impacts and thinking through how to do things differently in the present and in the future. So I think that memory is important, material memory in a social, ecological, economic, and yeah, that sort of sense.
So there's kind of two steps, right? There's the working with the materials, and then the way that we work with the materials, the actual process that kind of both what it is and what it does, you know, that kind of relationship between what the material is, but also what we do with it, the conversations we have. Did you and Hannah talk a lot about the nature of the collaboration in terms of the environment, in terms of working in Aotearoa, what that meant?
I think it's something that we came together on through our own journeys. Mm-hmm. And sort of part of why we started collaborating with Wesley as well was because of that shared belief in sort of environmental art and art that talks to the climate crisis and our geographical histories, mm-hmm. and colonial histories. Yeah, in that sense, we're all coming from a place where we think it's really important to speak to it. And with Hannah and our collaboration, our ongoing collaboration, it sort of looks like, I guess, yeah, we independently research and then come together to make for one idea. Yeah.
But you don't only work in aluminium, right?
No, I work with, many different materials.
Yeah. And how do you make those decisions about materials? Right.
Sorry, I definitely get lost. You've got to pull me back. Well, for this one, it was because they sort of feel like plaques, and I was quite interested in the way that we give words that life and that longevity. And there's something so permanent and often colonial about it. Plaques are often a way of like stamping, claiming things. So I sort of liked the way it felt like something I could like offer was to sort of do this at an intimate scale, you know, like on the floor in my studio, and to kind of offer that to the collaboration and the partnership and the work.
Into the work, into the environment, that like offering.
Yeah, I think I also see that as like, in terms of you saying like the way with that offers hope. For me, that's like through collaboration and coming together, and each sort of bringing something to it. Yeah.
I think one of the things I've been thinking about a lot, especially in our current climate, is you just mentioned hope. what kinds of strategies we have, what kinds of ways of working that are also ways of being that we might have as makers and thinkers and writers. And one of the questions I sent to you guys a couple of weeks ago was, what artistic strategies do you respect? Like, what kinds of things are other people doing that you respect? And what can we, like, adopt? What can we use from them? Were there particular things that sort of came to mind with that question?
Yeah, I think play is an important strategy. It's a way through all sorts of tensions, whether those are cultural, social, economic, historical, ecological, that I think that our capacity for play is an important way through all sorts of issues. And for artists, it can be a way through different kinds of blocks within your practice, or a way of developing new strands or new directions within your work. And when we think about that in relation to memory and story, I think that becomes even more important, that there can be a playfulness to the way we approach storytelling and history telling that, yeah, allows us to have difficult conversations in hopeful ways. Yeah.
Often play is presented as something you do so that you don't have to think about the main thing. You know, it's sort of pushed off to the side, and you're sort of suggesting actually the play is one of our key techniques, one of the things that we need to hold on to.
Well, it allows things to surface, doesn't it? And yeah. If you think about the history, play has been a strategy used by artists in all and there's a long history of it, right, in many different cultures beyond a sort of Western or colonial art historical canon. But within that sort of, within that history, we can think about Dada and Surrealist artists using play as a way through the sort of overly rational, into allowing the irrational and the unconscious and the subconscious to surface, different ways of thinking about things, different solutions. That and I think I mean, children are great teachers, aren't they, for that sort of thing.
Is play central in what you're doing? Or are there other strategies that...
I don't know if it's necessarily central to how I approach it, but I find it really interesting. I think I'm quite interested in the intersection of like art and social sculpture, mm-hmm. or the ways that like practical making can live on. I was like, For the Love of Bees in Tamaki is like an interesting example of like an artwork that then went on to have like real presence and sort of build community around it.
Is that how we might measure the success of an artwork, that it builds community, that it...
I don't think...
This might be a lot to ask.
Yeah, I don't think that necessarily, like, not every artwork's sort of striving to achieve that. So I don't think it's like the parameters to test a piece. I just think it's like a really interesting way that I can see art having real effect, if that makes sense. But if an artwork moves you, that's also, that's a riffle, that's something.
The subjective, in a personal sense, is just as important as the intersubjective, which is maybe where the collective or the community happens, that intersubjective level of art happening to you and happening around you. I think the other thing I would say about play is that it helps us break down binaries. So if we think about it in the context of this exhibition and the 2021 exhibition, you've got this interest in the non-human and the more than human, which is a way of resisting the primacy of the human or the binary between human and non-human, and thinking more through interconnectedness and interrelatedness. And I think play helps us resist binaries.
And I think there's, in the current context, there's a lot of responsibility placed upon artists. Like, you can help us answer these massive problems that are sitting in front of us. Often artists are told, look, we've run out of words, we've tried everything we can and no one's listening, so now you guys have a go. And that's a heavy weight to bear, I think, as an artist. And so it's like there's a dual level to that sense of responsibility. It's like you want to be able to respond to the climate crisis, to what's kind of framed as the Anthropocene. But actually having that placed upon you is often a lot. And so how we share that in the different way, the different strategies we have for making art, I think are really important.
Yeah, purity and perfectionism can get in the way of just making some steps toward change, you know. So if we, it's like, I don't know, in teaching I find a lot, it's really helpful to talk to students, particularly first year students, around resisting perfectionism, because it gets in the way of a whole lot of stuff.
And kind of something I see in both of your works is this kind of generosity in terms of an opening up, that both of them feel very generous works. They're opening up discussions and sort of offering things out to people. What people then do with that is often their own responsibility, right? It's like you can't be responsible for that as well.
I mean, ideally they're all starting points, I suppose, for somebody's journey or researching or wherever it takes them.
Yeah. So one of the bigger contexts that we've been thinking with as we've been putting this series of exhibitions together, which you just kind of alluded to, is what are the ways of working as artists, as thinkers, as writers, as curators, with more than just human frameworks? Like, how do we move beyond just a human framework to start thinking about other ways of being and knowing in the world and kind of touching on those without speaking for them? I'm never going to speak for Hei Totoro. Hei Totoro has more than enough stories. But hopefully Sophie and I can kind of open a space where those conversations can begin. And a lot of that, and certainly in my thinking as a writer, has been happening inside the context of the Anthropocene. And grappling with what this word Anthropocene means and what it offers us. And as a number of you will know, just last week, the International Geological Society decided to reject the term Anthropocene as the term for what's going on at the moment. And I got a note just this morning from one of my collaborators who I've been working with on this word Anthropocene for the past 10 years. She's a social scientist. She's based in Switzerland now, and she's very much working in the world of policy. And it was just really interesting to get this note at the same time that we were thinking these things. And I'll just tell you what she says. Her email was headed up, Patriarchy and the Anthropocene. Okay, what's Christine got to say? And she says, I thought of you as I read the news that the geologists have decided to reject the Anthropocene as a geologic epoch. She was clearly involved in some of the discussions that were going on, and she said it was very, very messy. She then says, it's an unhappy ending for the committee. It also strikes me as being utterly ironic that an institution with such a long, white, patriarchal and colonial past is the body that gets the final say on an issue that is essentially all about human behaviour. And I thought, you know, thank you, Christine, but also I had not kind of, I'd been like, not really knowing what we might do next with this. And again, her reminder for me was, once again, they're telling the story. And they're controlling the story. And so my first act is like a refusal. I'm going to keep using the word because the word is about human relations with the planet and the way that we navigate that. And actually for me, it feels possibly even more important to keep using the word, especially if the old white guys have rejected it. And I'm interested to hear from each of you how that kind of framing works for you. It's a very complicated framing. Is it useful? Is it not useful?
Yeah, I was thinking about this question this morning, and you're probably both familiar with Zoe Todd's critiques of the term and the sort of understanding from from her Indigenous perspective that, at least within a North American context, that early on in the sort of use of that term within the arts, there was an acknowledgement or the critique. I think she first published about that around 2016, and obviously the term had been around for longer than that, but it sort of started to surface quite a lot in the arts around that time, and her critique was, well, yeah, I get it, but at the same time, this term, the Anthropocene, generalises, and it doesn't specify, you know, where that human-induced impact originated, how it came about, what were the systemic things, what were the colonial aspects to that, what's the sort of racialised perspective on, or the way that those processes, racialised aspects of the human population or members of the human population in ways that exploited their labour and their land and their all of these sorts of issues, that the way the term the Anthropocene was being theorised didn't make space for at that time. And I think those critiques have had a big impact and shifted those conversations and surfaced a lot of that stuff. And so even someone like Zoe Todd, who was critiquing the use of the term, now still uses it, you know, like she's used it as recently as the last year or two as a tool within that ongoing work that she's doing.
Because it becomes a way to actually highlight those inequalities and to highlight the problems of this thing that that sort of sits there in a space that can be avoided by some people, and as she was saying, can never be avoided by other people. And yeah, sort of becomes a shapeshifter in its own way. One of the other ways that I like to think about it, and perhaps kind of returns to those ideas of hope and possibility, is what kinds of strategies we need now, what kinds of stories we need to tell now in this, again, a moment where we can acknowledge it's a moment of changing thought patterns and definitely changing priorities in terms of the major stories that are being told in this country at the moment that don't necessarily make the minor stories, which are actually the major stories, go away. What kinds of strategies do you have as artists, or might you want to engage with? What kinds of stories do we want to tell? What kinds of practices are necessary now? Whether that's like for yourself or for all of us.
This might tie back, it's not necessarily the strategy, but pins back to the previous thought. My thoughts sort of disappeared because I got tied into the idea of the Anthropocene and this sort of paralysis, climate paralysis, but then also using this umbrella as a space to sort of see human impact as inevitable, and all of the webs around that. Because I think it's quite a big framework to try create mahi in, and also, like, I think there's something really beautiful in the show as well, like taking a piece from the archives, like localized stories really make it feel like hope is possible, or that there's ways. So like learning about the land where you live and the histories of the places you go every day, I think really tie you into investing and understanding where you are, I think.
Yeah, and letting those stories be challenged through intergenerational dialogue, right? Like, so as a tangata tiriti artist, like learning around, learning a little around concepts of whakapapa and other ways that stories are told to acknowledge the intergenerational and interspecies and all these different modes of relationship and story. But if you bring that back to the idea of play as well, like that letting children interrogate the stories we tell and letting grandparents talk back, or, you know, like that, those sort of the conversational approach to story is important, I think. Yeah.
Does a story exist if it hasn't got someone to hear it? Like, it's that, you know, a story is always a form of exchange, a form of conversation, which is kind of at the core of your work. Mm. You know, it was a conversation. I think a story needs feedback and response as well as the telling, or grows and changes through that as well.
I always think about it in relation to like art, especially because the stories are what like unlock the works often, especially in contemporary conceptual art making. Like knowing the history of Susan's piece completely transforms it and allows you like an in to it.
Yeah. It's really challenging, isn't it? Because the artwork holds its own story, and then you bring a story to it. Or you might take a story from it in extractive mode, but it's kind of this real tension there, I think. It's not one that we're going to be able to answer today. My other note here, and we're nearly out of time, is the impossible question I asked you, which is how are stories material and material story? But actually, I think that that has actually been the theme that we've sort of covered over the past kind of 40 minutes, that movement across materials and across stories in this moment of time, whether we call it the Anthropocene or not, but it's a time of more than human forms of engagement and forms of knowing, ways of being together as well, in community or in company, I think is something that I see in both of your works. Is there anything either of you want to kind of finish off with before we wrap up?
Oh, I would say in terms of that question of material and memory and story, like when I thought of that question, I was like, oh, okay, well, yeah, like we need to think of material in all the possible senses of that word, and that material and materialism can be understood in lots of different ways, and that the sort of the social and the economic and the sort of manifestation of labour that is present in materials, and the ecological and the physical and the create, you know, like all these different ways of understanding material helps us then understand how it relates to memory and how it relates to story.
Yeah, I don't know if I have any closing thoughts. I'm still in the pool of the different places the conversation went, I think. But I guess the stories we tell are important. And the different threads of those and how we share them is an ongoing sort of conversation.
I think that's a lovely place to end, with sharing stories as an ongoing conversation. So I want to thank both Raewyn and Tan for your time, for your thoughts, for your sizzling thoughts, and also thank you guys for listening, because as I said, a story doesn't exist without an audience, without people listening. So thank you all. Thank you everyone for being here. Kia ora.